Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Korach. This week, Rabbi Meir Schweiger discusses Korach. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior faculty member at Pardes and serves as the Pardes Mashgiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
Thank you, Larry. This week's parsha is Parshat Korach. In a previous podcast, I discussed how the first 10 chapters of the book of Bamidbar discuss the structuring of the Jewish people to create an ideal reality. At the core of the Jewish people is the tabernacle and its courtyard. Surrounding the tabernacle, we find the families of Levi. Surrounding the families of Levi, we find the general Jewish population. There is a certain hierarchical structure which is created. In many ways, what happens in the beginning of Bamidbar parallels chapter 1 of Genesis. God creates a world. There's a certain hierarchical structure in that world. Everything created in that world has its place. And within the larger structure, every single thing is seen as tov. The whole structure is tov ma'od. In chapter 2 of Bereishit, the emphasis is on the creation of the Garden of Eden. The Garden of Eden, which in a way parallels the tabernacle. It is a place where God's presence is to be found. It is a place where the ultimate goal is service of God. Just as in the book of Bereishit, after this beautiful world is created by God, in chapters 1 and 2, we find immediately in chapter 3, the beginning of a series of stories in which people unravel that reality, in which the world which was tov ma'od, very good, at the end of the parsha of Bereishit, is described as being ra, where man is described as rak ra. Kol machshavot libo, rak ra, kol hayom. All of the thoughts of his heart are only evil. In a similar vein, we have an unraveling of a magnificent structure in the book of Bamidbar, which begins in chapter 11. And in rapid succession, we have five stories where that structure unravels, where as a result of that, we have a whole generation which is destined to die in the desert. Our parsha is the last in that series of stories. Today, what I would like to do is to examine in greater depth the five stories, to see them as a unit, and to see how ultimately these stories may have similarities to what we find in the book of Bereishit, and as a result, reflect something very profound about the human reality and human nature. So let us begin. In chapter 11, verse 1, we are told, Vayhi am kimit onanim, and the people, and the word mit onanim is unclear. In the translation which I have, it says, and the people began to complain, ra, evilly, in the ears of God. And God hears and becomes angry. And then all of a sudden, fire comes out and consumes the edge of the camp. When we read this one line, it is very, very unclear what exactly is going on. And I think that is purposeful, because there isn't anything very, very clear-cut which is actually happening. Let me begin by saying, who is doing this? The Am. Rashi, in a number of places, says that whenever it says the Am, it generally means the masses, the hoi polloi, One could even perhaps make the case the periphery. What are they doing? Mit onanim, complaining. But if we read carefully, we see it's ra ba'oznei Hashem, evil in the ears of God. This is not something which is done publicly. This is murmuring under one's breath. The Ramban understands mit onanim from the language onain, which refers to someone who has just experienced the death of a close relative. And he says that mit onanim means mitzta'arim. They feel bad. They're in pain. About what? It doesn't say. And perhaps that's the point. There isn't anything specific which is bothering them. It is a general feeling of discomfort. As they begin their journey in the desert to ultimately come into the land of Israel, the whole process makes them feel uncomfortable. Could be the heat. Could be the fatigue of journeying. Could be the food, as we will see in a moment. But what matters to me is that it is not defined. It is a general feeling of discomfort. One could even make the point that by using this word onanim, which is a term that's used when a close relative dies, and in fact, it's the term that's used immediately after death, before the burial. That person is called an onain. Using that term would seem to express a deep sense of pain, a deep sense of loss. Over what? And perhaps that's the point. There isn't anything, objectively speaking, which is so painful. There is no uprising over here. It is simply people who are perhaps under their breath, mumbling, grumbling. That is why it is evil in the ears of God. God hears it. But it's not something which is necessarily so publicly visible. Nevertheless, God's reaction is immediate. Fire goes out, consumes the edge of the camp. And once again, it is not clear. Did people die? It never actually says people died. Perhaps there is fire, which is just a kind of flash, warning. Stop grumbling. The other thing which I'll just point out is similar to what we find in the book of Bereishit. All of a sudden, the word evil comes up. The response of the people is actually very positive. The people cry out to Moshe. And the way that we could understand this is that the people are not complaining, but on the contrary, looking for help. And Moshe prays, the fire subsides, and perhaps we could say that there is an initial problem which was resolved. But then we move on to the next story. And that is chapter 11, verse 4. It says, the Asafsuf, which is translated again in my translation as the rabble, or you could say the gathering of misfits who are in the midst of the Jewish people, all of a sudden desired. And they go and they cry, also the Jewish people. So what is happening now? Whereas in the previous story, it was the Am, the periphery, that are grumbling. All of a sudden, this periphery is in the midst of the Jewish people. All of a sudden, they are impacting so that not only are they crying, but also the Jewish people are crying. And all of a sudden, there is an outcry. We want meat. And we remember what it was like in Egypt when we had the cucumbers and the watermelons and the onions and the garlic. And maybe I'll skip one verse. In verse 10, it says, and Moshe heard the Am crying according to families, each one at the entrance to his tent, which means that all of a sudden there's been a certain movement now, a shift, whereas earlier, whatever the people were murmuring about was in the ears of God. Now all of a sudden, Moshe hears, whereas earlier it was something which is perhaps under their breath. Now, all of a sudden, this is something which is being done publicly, but publicly crying out according to their families at the entrance of their tents. There isn't a mass gathering against Moshe. It just seems that there is a general outcry. What is it that the people are crying about? It's being articulated. It's not just their mit-onanim vaguely. We want meat. But on the other hand, what you see is they all of a sudden discuss fish in zucchini, watermelons, onions. So what is it that they really want? And if we look at what's driving them, ta'ava, desire, lust. What is it that they want? Perhaps they articulate it when they say in verse 6, our souls are dry, we do not have kol, which we can translate as we do not have anything, or we do not have everything, which means because they have a desire, their desire wants them to have everything. It isn't just a question of meat. They remember the zucchini. They remember the fish. It's the idea that what they have now is the man. And somehow the man does not give them everything which they want. The language of desire appears in the story of the Garden of Eden. Eve looks at the tree of knowledge of good and evil. She desires it. She sees that it's good to be eaten. It is beautiful to the sight. I think the parallel between the two stories is unquestionable. In both stories, there is a similar issue. In both cases, people do not have absolute control over their destiny. In both cases, it is God who dictates what they shall eat. And because of that, it puts a limit on their possibilities. In the Garden of Eden, they basically can eat everything. One tree they can't eat. The moment I don't have that one tree, what value do the other trees have? And by the same token, in the desert, what do we have? The manna. And although the Torah goes to great lengths to describe how the manna can in many ways be everything that you could possibly want, but the people feel dry. They feel denied. And all of that is because of their desire. The desire to be able to have everything, to be totally in control of your reality. If I go back for a moment, I could say that in the initial story, the mit-onanim, what are the people grumbling about? There isn't anything in particular, but it may be because of this larger issue. They are ultimately not in control of what they're doing. It is God who makes that determination. Where they travel, when they travel, how they travel, all of that is decided by God, and that is unsettling. In the end, the people are given meat, but it is clear as the story unfolds that that desire which they have will not be quenched. God actually says to them, I will pour it on. You will eat until you get sick of it, and you will die. And yet somehow it seems, perhaps this is the nature of desire. Once your desire is fulfilled, there's always the next thing to desire. There will always be the next thing that will, in fact, irritate you. And that's why I come back to what I said a moment ago. The issue is a much larger issue. Ultimately, who is running the show? Is it God or is it the people? Are they the ones to decide their destiny or God? In the middle of this story, there is a kind of tangential element which, as we go along, becomes central. And that is when Moshe tries to plead the case of the Jewish people, He says, how can I possibly bear this people? I need help. And God agrees. And God tells him to gather together 70 elders who will help him in the task of leading the people. On the one hand, this is a very, very positive development because it enables Moshe to perhaps have a better control over what's going on with the people, control in a positive sense, to be able to exercise, perhaps I should say, better leadership by delegating authority. But the result of this is the beginning of a process which undermines the leadership of Moshe. And we can see that at the end of that section. There are two people, Eldad and Medad, who are prophesying in the camp, where it's clear that their prophecy is not an extension of Moshe's, but independent of Moshe. And I won't even get into the rabbinic comment which says the content of their prophecy has to do with Moshe dying and Joshua bringing the people into the land. As they prophesy, Joshua comes to the defense of Moshe. And Joshua says, we can't allow this. These people have to be locked up. It has to be made clear there is a hierarchy. What they have done is a rejection of Moshe, of his authority, a challenge to Moshe. And Moshe's response in chapter 11, verse 29, are you jealous for me? Would that all the people of God be prophets, that God should place a spirit on them. Moshe is articulating a very significant point. Moshe tells Joshua, prophecy, having an I-thou relationship with God, should not be just the legacy of one person. It should be open to everyone. Moshe demonstrates what it means to be a true leader. Perhaps he is the first among equals, but he certainly does not see himself as having an exclusive relationship with God, which means to deny others of that relationship. Ultimately, it is God who makes the decision who he brings into relationship with him. And Moshe is very happy to expand the circle, to include others in that relationship. But this, in fact, creates a breach, which then leads to the next story, chapter 12. Miriam and Aaron speak out against Moshe. And once again, I would like to emphasize, this is not public. This is a conversation between the two of them, which perhaps they bring Moshe into. They speak about this Cushite woman that Moshe took. It is unclear what exactly are they saying, but I think the key is the next verse, chapter 12, verse 2. When they say, did God speak only with Moshe? Did God not also speak with us? And once again it says, and God heard. Note the parallel between this story and the first story. God hears, nobody else hears. In effect, what are they saying? There is no difference between Moshe and us. And if there is no difference, then why is Moshe perhaps acting differently? There is an implicit criticism of Moshe, perhaps an insinuation of Moshe being holier than thou. I would like to say that the previous story is what enables this conversation. The moment Eldad and Medad receive prophecy independent of Moshe, on a certain level, that undermines the prophetic role of Moshe. Joshua sees that. Moshe brushes it off. And somehow that allows for Aaron and Miriam to also undermine the unique role of Moshe. And immediately we find in the continuation of the story, God puts them in their place. God says, don't you realize who Moshe is? Don't you realize that he is my servant? He is the most faithful of my household. I speak to him face to face. Different than the way that I speak to others. How could you possibly have not thought in speaking against Moshe? And once again, God is angry at them. The anger of God seems to be a recurring theme here, similar to what we had in the first story. But this time, instead of fire coming out, we have the cloud, the other symbol of the presence of God, which rather than coming and consuming, departs. It's a kind of inverse imagery. And the result of it is that Miriam becomes leprous. And as Aaron describes her in verse 12, let her not be as one who is dead. So that although Miriam doesn't actually die, symbolically, she is dead. She is rejected by God. So perhaps let me just summarize at this moment. What have we just discussed? In chapter 11 and 12, we have three stories which form a mini unit. Chapter 11, the people are uncomfortable, the first verse. In the second story, the people have desire. They openly complain. The two stories share in common the fact that what is bothering the people is they're being locked into a certain box. The fact that they don't have the ability to ultimately determine where they're going, what they eat. It is ultimately in the hands of God. Similar to what perhaps is happening in the beginning of Bereshit, when Adam and Eve seem to be very upset at the fact that God does not allow them to eat from the tree of knowledge. Because they want to be godlike. They want to be able to have absolute control over their destiny. And perhaps this reflects something, as I said, fundamental about human nature. People would like to feel godlike. People would like to feel that they have absolute control. People have difficulty with limitations that are being placed upon them. People are unable, perhaps, to accept what they have and be happy with it, but desire, want something which is beyond who they are, would like to be something which they are not, which ultimately destroys them. But then we have another issue, and the other issue is the undermining of the leadership of Moshe, the authority of Moshe. It begins in chapter 11 with the 70 elders who now become his assistants. But that is then reinforced when there are two Eldad and Medad who are prophesying in the camp, who seem to have an independent channel with God other than Moshe, so that Moshe does not have a monopoly on prophecy. Moshe does not seem to be bothered by that. Moshe throughout seems to be willing to forego his status, his authority, because he's able to see the larger picture of the good of the Jewish people. But that breach widens in chapter 12 as Miriam and Aaron speak out against Moshe, privately, not publicly. But nevertheless, the fact that they articulate it is something which is very disturbing to God. The fact that they have lost a sense of the qualitative difference between them and Moshe, the fact that they now create this common denominator which destroys any sense of a chain of command where God is at the top, Moshe is below, and then we have the rest of the people. And perhaps to just add, the two symbols of the presence of God in the beginning of chapter 11, the fire which comes and consumes the edge of the camp. The end of chapter 12, the cloud, which rather than coming, departs. Both of which perhaps result in some form of death. Now we go on to chapter 13. Chapter 13, in the beginning of chapter 14, discusses the sin of the spies. And I would like to just focus on the beginning of chapter 14. When the people hear the report of the spies, it says the whole congregation raises up its voice and they cry, and the people cry that night. Remember earlier, we began with the Am. We then move to the Jewish people in the continuation of chapter 11. Now in the sin of the spies, the motivator in the sin are the 10 spies, men of distinction. Those 10 spies were able to then get the whole congregation to lift up their voice. And all of a sudden, that whole congregation perhaps becomes an Am, acting in a way like a mass group of people. They complain on Moshe and on Aaron. It is no longer, as we find in chapter 11, people who are crying at the entrance to their tent. But it seems to be that we now have a whole congregation which is gathered, which are complaining, shouting, raising their voices against Moshe, and basically saying to them, we wish we had died in Egypt, or perhaps in the desert. And why is God bringing us to this land where we will fall by the sword? Our wives and children will be taken captive, will be violated. Isn't it better that we should, isn't it tov lanu, isn't it good to us to go back to Egypt? Remember, I spoke about this whole question of good and evil. The good is the land of Israel. The good is the structure of the camp, the journeys that God has created that are ultimately bringing the people to actualize their destiny. And what have the people done? The people have inverted things. Good is to go back to Egypt. Okay? Ra is the situation which they find themselves in. Coming to the land is Ra. Note another thing. The people say, why is God bringing us to this land to fall by the sword? What has happened now? It is not only a question of people who are complaining, who are uncomfortable, who have desires, of people who perhaps are ungrateful for all that God has given them, which, by the way, is true in the Garden of Eden. But there's a certain element over here of demonization. It's not just that God is not giving us everything that we want, that God is something holding back. God is actually leading us to our deaths. What kind of God is this? It's a demonic God, which means that people have totally inverted, confused what ultimately is good and what ultimately is evil. I would perhaps connect this with this theme that I've been trying to develop, that ultimately in the story of the spies, what's so disturbing to the people, and why they cry, so bitterly cry, why they complain, is because the people feel that they no longer have control over their destiny. And as a result of that, the people are now bemoaning their fate. And not only that, but they feel that this lack of control over their destiny is demonic, is ultimately a God who is toying with them, who is not interested in empowering them, is not interested in their good, but is interested perhaps in asserting his power and destroying them. Note that in the continuation of the story, the glory of God in verse 10 appears as a kind of defense for Joshua and Caleb, who try to reverse the mindset of the people and say to them in verse 7, the land that we have gone to spy out, that land is tova, is good, ma'od, ma'od, very, very good. We can perhaps hear the echoes of chapter 1 in Bereshit, when God looks at the world that he created, and it was Tov Ma'od. Kalev and Joshua reflect the mindset of God, but the people reflect a different reality, which has rejected that. And as we know, in last week's parsha, the decree is given to have a whole generation which will die in the desert. Let me just add one postscript. After the people hear the decree, the people mourn, but then there is another reaction. The other reaction is, and this is in chapter 14, verse 40, there is once again a group of people, perhaps the Am mentioned in the previous verse, who get up early in the morning, who do not accept what has just been decreed upon them, and who now want to take their destiny into their own hands, who perhaps want to adopt a positive view by acknowledging the fact that, yes, we have sinned, but we want to now correct that sin. And Moshe's response is, it's too late. You can't do it. But nevertheless, they do not accept no for an answer. They insist on going up the mountain, actualizing their destiny, but it's too late for that. And all the people who try are utterly destroyed. This is an interesting postscript because what it shows is there's a certain positive twist to the story. The people want to go up the mountain. They want to correct what they did. They want to take their destiny into their hands, but they want to do it according to their agenda. And Moshe tries to make it clear to them. Ultimately, it is God who outlines your destiny. Accept that. Accept the limitations. When they don't, there is utter destruction. After this long preview, we finally come to our parsha. In our parsha, we have the coup de grace. And let me explain what I mean by that. Korach launches a rebellion. Ostensibly, the issue is who is fit to serve God. And the argument which is made in chapter 16, verse 3, the whole congregation is holy, and God is in their midst. Why do you rule over the congregation of God? If we think about it, this story echoes what we saw in the end of chapter 11 and chapter 12. When Eldad and Medad are prophesying, should they be locked up, as Joshua says, or as Moshe says? Would that all of the people of God be prophets? Moshe, who articulated equality before God, who articulated that he does not have a monopoly on prophecy, he does not have a monopoly on that I-thou relationship. Moshe, who, because of that, is then attacked by Miriam and Aaron, who say that, did God speak only to you? God spoke to us also. Why are you different? That initial breach now reaches its full expression. When the people, Korach, gathers together a group who basically say everybody is holy. Why do you lord over everybody? Why do you have a monopoly on the temple service? Why can't anybody do it? Whereas earlier before we were talking about prophecy, now we're talking about the temple service. Whereas earlier it was an issue that was raised by Miriam and Aaron, now all of a sudden it is raised publicly in a very ugly way, and also in a way which is a total rejection of Moshe's authority. And not only that, but very pejorative. Who are you to rule over us? But in chapter 11, we saw that Moshe said, I don't feel I have a monopoly And ultimately, whoever God wishes to bring in, more power to them. In the story of Miriam and Aaron, they speak among themselves. It is not a public issue, but it is nevertheless Moshe's inner circle that are somehow questioning his special status. Now all of a sudden, it is the extension of Moshe's inner circle, the tribe of the Levites, the people who were his right-hand arm at the sin of the golden calf, when Moshe said, "Who is to God? Come forth to me." The people who were loyal to Moshe, who ultimately defended him and the glory of God in the midst of the people. And these same people are now challenging Moshe, undermining his authority. Who are you to rule over us? Who are you to decide who will approach God? And as I said, this is being done in a very public and ugly manner. This is what makes our parsha so problematic. When we look in the beginning of Bereshit, there are two sins which perhaps create a precedent for later human reality. The first is the sin of Adam and Eve eating the tree of knowledge. And as I mentioned before, it is the desire which is within human beings to somehow go beyond themselves, the desire to see themselves as being the center of the universe, so that everything which exists should be within their control. Implicitly, it is a rejection of being under the rule of God. A rejection of being under the rule of God because of the feeling, I am all-powerful. Of the feeling of, I want to be gratified, to feel that I have everything. And we find that element in chapter 11, and also, I think, in chapter 13 and 14 with the spies. And perhaps to add to that, the feeling of discomfort being somehow under the rule of God, which then leads to the expression of how ultimately there's a power struggle, and God is not interested in the well-being of human beings, but ultimately just to rule over them. And by the way, I would say that that idea is also reflected in what this says in our parsha, when Moshe is told, why do you rule over us? Moshe is being seen as this God figure who doesn't allow them to do what they want. But there's a second element. And the second element has to do with what are the parameters of service of God and the problematics. And that comes up in the story of Cain and Abel. And it raises a very interesting question. To what degree is it that one does service of God, which may in fact be self-serving? When Cain brings the offering to God, which is rejected, it may be rejected because the offering is not a proper offering and was ultimately not really being given to God, but perhaps was for Cain's sake, to get acknowledgement. And this issue of engaging in spiritual activity and understanding that a relationship with God is something which ultimately God sets the parameters for, and where one has to ask themselves, is my relationship with God really for God or for me, comes to a head also in our story. Moshe becomes a model. When Moshe says, would that all the people be prophets, Moshe is articulating that a relationship with God is something for God to determine. When Moshe perhaps separates from his wife, the Isha Kushit, as the rabbis understand it, because God has told him to do it, it is not because Moshe wants to get acknowledgement from the people as being holier than thou, but because this is what is essential in the service of God. When Korach and his people impose themselves and say, why should only you be the ones to serve God? Why can't we serve God? Is the issue really service of God, or is the issue self-service? Interestingly, in the story, fire comes down, consumes the 250 men, and in a sense creates a certain closure with the beginning of chapter 11. It's kind of ironic, because in chapter 11 we said it's the the periphery, who are sinning. In this chapter, it's the very significant, perhaps a core element of the people who are sinning. Earlier, it was people who were mumbling about nothing in particular. Now it is people who are engaged in service of God, the ultimate service of God. Yet, interestingly enough, the two stories come to the same end. And so I would like to conclude. As I mentioned, we have five stories. Just for the sake of intellectual honesty, there's actually a sixth story, which has to do with someone who is violating Shabbat, which appears in chapter 15, in last week's parasha, chapter 15, verse 32. That I didn't relate to. I'll leave that for another time. But let me stay for the moment with the five stories we have, and say that these five stories, in many ways, repeat on a conceptual level what we have in the stories of Bereshit. And basically what they show is human reality, which can very often take something which is very, very good and transmute it into something evil. It could be a result of desire, but it may ultimately be a result of an inability to accept the human condition of the fact that human beings do not have absolute control over their destiny, but ultimately are in relationship with God. Perhaps let me end by mentioning something which appeared at the end of last week's parsha, which we are familiar with from the third paragraph of the Shema. When the Torah speaks about the mitzvah of tzitzit, it says, and you shall see them and remember the commandments of God, and do not go after your heart in your eyes, which you tend to go astray after. And what I would like to end with is, to what degree is it that we see ourselves as being at the core of reality, and that everything that exists in reality revolves around us? To what degree is it that we need to be gratified, to be acknowledged, to be empowered, to feel that we have total control over our destiny? Or at what point is it that God is at the center of our reality, and the commandments of God become the guidelines for how we behave? To what degree do we accept our limitations, whether it be in the realm of the material or in the realm of the spiritual? To what degree are we prepared within those parameters to actualize our destiny, to take responsibility for our actions? Or to what degree is it that we would like to have our cake and eat it too, to be given everything, but to feel that we really did it? These are very, very serious questions, which I think these parshiot raise. As I said, our parsha is the conclusion of this series of sins. After this, we no longer hear of the people sinning, or perhaps I should say, that generation. In next week's parsha, we have a dramatic shift, where all of a sudden, 40 years have gone by, and we now have a new generation. Perhaps one of the themes which comes up again and again in the Torah is that as much as human reality fails there is nevertheless other opportunities that then present themselves. These stories are written here to learn from. Hopefully, we can perhaps each of us in our own way see these stories and ask ourselves, how do they resonate with our reality? To what degree do each of us in our reality desire things which perhaps are beyond our capacity? To what degree is it that we are unable to be happy with what we have? And sometimes to be unhappy because it's very demanding upon us, and look for other things which are more comfortable, more readily available, even if they're not for our good. In our service of God, are we truly serving God, or are we serving ourselves? Are we doing service of God because this is tov, this is what is good to be done? Or are we doing service of God because we have an ulterior motive? We stand to gain by it, whether materially or socially. As I said, these are serious questions which all of us should ask, and hopefully learn from these stories and create a much better reality. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated, so please send an email to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you in the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.